KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education in Psychology, offering a master's in clinical psychology with an MFT. Priority deadline to apply for September classes is May 28th. gsep.pepperdine.edu.
From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Josie Huang, filling in for A. Martinez. Thank you, as always, for joining us. We have a lot of news to cover on today's show, including updates on various pieces of legislation working their way through the California Assembly. We also have the second story in our series on electric heavy-duty trucks in Los Angeles.
We get people that, as we're driving down the road, they'll pull their cell phones out, and not the safest thing, but we get a lot of questions and inquiries.
We talked to the founders of LA startup Exos about making a loud statement with a quiet truck. That's coming up in about 30 minutes. But we start today in Sacramento with a debate on a topic that's been getting a lot of attention recently, charter schools.
We saw during the LA Unified Teacher Strike that charters do take away from public schools. And what began as a model has now become an industry.
That's Riverside Democrat Jose Medina on the floor yesterday, urging his colleagues to pass a sweeping package of legislation aimed at reining in the growth of charter schools. In the LA Unified School District alone, charters enroll more than 130,000 kids. The state teachers union is backing several charter limiting bills moving through the legislature. Assembly lawmakers passed part of that package yesterday, and another bill could get voted on as early as today. The California Charter Schools Association is worried passage could lead to a wave of charter schools being forced to shut down. To bring us up to speed on what's at stake, let's bring in KPCC's education reporter, Kyle Stokes. Hello, Kyle.
Hello, Josie.
So it's always worth a reset. Mm-hmm. What are charter schools and why are they so controversial?
Well, so charter schools are a type of publicly funded school, but they're not run by a school district. They're run kind of on their own by their own nonprofit organization. And so that means that they essentially compete with school districts for enrollment and therefore for funding, because funding is very much tied to enrollment in California. And they're also somewhat controversial because a lot of them are not unionized. But I really think you got to focus on the financial implications, too. I mean, that's not the, you know, the unionization thing is not the only reason why teachers unions have made charter schools so much a focus of their organizing efforts in the strikes that were mentioned just there. You know, teachers unions see charter schools as draining away, funding away. And when you drain away the funding, you leave a school district that's hollowed out of kids, but that still is costly to operate. And so the margins for school districts really diminish. And so that's why they've been so controversial, why so much of the teachers union activism over the last year we've seen with strikes up and down the state have been focused on do something about charter schools.
Yeah, I remember the teachers unions, the teachers out there chanting about having anti-charter school slogans when they were out there picketing. So back to this legislation that's moving through Sacramento. Why is it that charter school advocates are so worried these bills could lead to charter school closures?
Well, take the bill that passed yesterday. It was AB 1505. What you have to understand about charter schools is so they're not run by the school district, but they do need the school district's permission or the permission of what's called an authorizer to open. So the way the process works is essentially it's like, I've got this great idea to start a new school that I don't want to start within the confines of a school district. I want to strike out on my own, start a charter school to do so. But if you want to do it, you've got to go to an authorizer and say, give me a charter so that I can go out and start enrolling students. What AB 1505 did is make it a lot easier for school districts to say no, to deny these people who are going out to seek a new charter. It's called a petition. Petitioning for a charter makes it much more difficult for you to secure a new charter, to make a new charter petition. And if you're trying to renew a charter that already exists, you got to do this every 5 years. The idea is that you keep, you know, keep a charter on their toes, you keep a school on their toes. The bill would also make it easier to deny a renewal for a charter school that you need every 5 years in order to stay open. And it also would, if enacted as currently written, would take away any rights that a charter would have to appeal a decision that wasn't made in their favor. So those are, I mean, you know, the bill's author authors say we're not trying to shut down charter schools, but the Charter Schools Association actually feels like this is a real existential threat, that it could give school districts essentially a blank check to shut down as many charter schools as they wanted to, or shut them down for potentially politically motivated reasons.
I have to say that some of what you're saying feels a little bit in the weeds to me. For instance, when you use language like authorizer, who is that? I mean, does it really matter that there is someone out there who authorizes a charter school, or how much power that they have?
Yeah, well, think about in LA Unified. LA Unified is an authorizer of charter schools, you know, and they oversee a portfolio of something like 200 schools. So it matters who's regulating these schools because, you know, for instance, in LA Unified, there are schools that are clearing thousands, millions of dollars through their books. And the authorizer's job is to make sure that they're being good stewards of that money, not only literally spending the money on what it should be spent on, but that kids are actually learning under the charter school's charge. And we've seen criminal charges in some very extreme and rare cases being leveled against charter operators that have made missteps. The authorizers are overseeing them. Part of the issue here, too, is that what, you know, the authors of these bills say is a problem is that if, you know, currently, if you're a charter operator and you want to start a school and you make this petition to start a charter, and then say the school district turns you down, well, you can take your petition then to, under current law, to the county or to the state, and they can authorize you. But that means that your authorizer, your regulator, is so much farther away, and they're concerned about that geographic distance and potentially the county or state offices being overstretched in overseeing those charter schools. They worry that that could have negative impacts, either that children won't be learning or that money will be misspent.
Well, okay, Kyle, we have just a minute left here. I wanted to ask you, of course, what is happening next with these bills? Is there any chance that they would become law?
Well, there's certainly a chance that they'll become law, but it's very difficult to say at this moment. Yesterday, this bill that we were talking about that changes up this whole authorizing process, this regulating authorizing process, it advanced through the assembly, but on a very, very close vote. Just enough Democrats stuck out their necks to make sure that this would pass through. And that's despite the fact that there were a bunch of teachers union activists storming around the halls of Sacramento yesterday, trying to urge them to pass this bill. So I think it's still a very controversial issue, and it's going to take a significant push from the teachers union if these bills are going to get passed.
All right. That's KPCC education reporter Kyle Stokes with this update. Thank you so much, Kyle.
You're welcome.
Moving on to a funeral for another bill. This one has to do with vaping. Health advocates have been pushing for a ban on flavored tobacco used in e-cigarettes. They worry that teens and even younger kids are drawn to vaping because of flavors like bubblegum or green apple. But this afternoon, just over an hour ago, in fact, the legislation got killed. For a state that has been on the leading edge of public health legislation, what exactly happened here? Elizabeth Aguilera covers healthcare for CalMatters and has been following the story, and she joins us now. Welcome, Elizabeth.
Hi, Josie.
Hi. I want to get to what happened in Sacramento this afternoon, but first, I want to ask you why a ban on flavored tobacco was even on the table. Why are growing rates of teen vaping such a concern to these health advocates?
Well, health advocates point to some of the statistics. So between 2017 and 2018, e-cigarettes drove 36% of the increase in tobacco use among teenagers. That's middle schoolers and high schoolers who shouldn't technically be able to access these products anyway. And e-cigarettes are marketed as a way for traditional smokers, adult smokers, to quit traditional cigarettes, right? So to give up combustible cigarettes. The e-cigs are vape pens. They allow you to heat up a liquid that typically has nicotine in it and then inhale that. But the experts and these public health officials are really concerned. They're seeing teens being really attracted to these products. And they say it's because the flavors, as you mentioned, are sweet and attractive, mm-hmm. and that the pens look really cool. The biggest maker makes one that looks like a really sleek USB flash drive.
Mm-hmm, which all the kids have. So how big an impact would a ban on flavored tobacco have on the industry? When I hear about like e-cigarettes, all the vaping juices have flavors. So it seems like it would have a big impact.
Yeah, the critics of the ban said it would have a big impact. So there are the sweet flavors that you mentioned. There's sort of fruity flavors and cream flavors. There are some straight up tobacco flavors, but I don't know that they're the most popular ones. It just depends on at what end you're coming into this scene. But the Vaping Association basically said that some retailers would lose about 90% of their product through a ban like this.
Mm-hmm. So that's no surprise then why e-cigarette makers were fighting this pretty hard. Is this kind of a first to see the e-cigarette industry up in Sacramento lobbying legislators? Because that's kind of been something that Big Tobacco has done traditionally.
Right, you're right. So tobacco companies, not new at all, right? They've been in Sacramento for a long time, supporting candidates for decades, hundreds of thousands of dollars, lots of influence. But for the e-cigarette makers, specifically Juul Labs, which is based in San Francisco, and that the federal government called out recently in a study that saying that they're one of the largest makers. They're garnering some of the largest market share of the products. They are definitely involved now, making campaign donations and, you know, out there lobbying.
And so giving money, giving campaign contributions, has it enabled them to have some more pull with these elected officials?
Well, the elected officials would say, of course, that whoever gives them money doesn't really have an influence. One of the chairmen of a committee, an assembly committee that killed a bunch of tobacco-related bills by just not hearing them at all, told us, you know, he accepts the support, but that they don't influence his decisions. But so far, that specific important committee on the assembly side has accepted among its members about $23,000 from Juul and about $89,000 from RJ Reynolds. And that's just so far this year.
Mm-hmm. So not chump change there. Well, you know, these e-cigarette makers probably are pretty happy with the outcome of today. But were they going for that? Were they trying to kill legislation entirely, or were they open to some kind of compromise or meeting health advocates halfway at least?
Well, they were concerned about this bill that wanted to fully ban flavored cigarette products or flavored vaping products. And they do say they don't want teenagers using their products. They go out of their way to educate kids and say this isn't for them. They want to make sure they say that kids are safe. But they do stand up for the fact that the product, they say, helps adult smokers, and they want it to be available to adult smokers who want to quit smoking. The lawmakers who are supported by these particular companies, you know, they've suggested that there are other things they could do instead of a ban. So they have said, you know, maybe they could focus on retailer penalties, like finding out who's selling to kids. They suggested maybe penalties for youth who are in possession of these products, although the public health advocates do not support that particular idea in terms of cracking down on kids who are possessing these items. Maybe advertising restrictions or age verification for online sales, that kind of stuff.
A lot of ideas there, but ultimately the bill died today. Can you talk about what happened? I mean, the bill sponsor, State Senator Jerry Hill, he decided to pull the bill. And why is that?
That's right. He withdrew the bill and he cited what he called hostile amendments. So if we go back to last week, it came out of an appropriations committee in the Senate. And in that committee, they said, we're passing this through to the Senate, but it has these specific amendments. And what they exempted were hookah, tobacco for hookah, and for tobacco products patented before the year 2000. And so the author, Senator Hill, said, you know, he was not supportive of these, as he said, hostile amendments. And he also lost the support of the American Lung Association, the American Heart Association, and the American Cancer Society, the Cancer Society Action Network. And they withdrew their support. They were in support, but now they changed their mind. So he just decided to pull it.
It wasn't worth it anymore. So is this bill dead? Is it coming back to life? Is it what's going to happen next?
You know, he doesn't plan to revive it because of the amendments, but it doesn't mean the idea is gone. This was the second bill that had this idea of the ban this session. The other one died in the assembly. Now he's withdrawn his bill, but he could try to bring something back like this next time.
So the bill is not really a factor right now. In the meantime, you mentioned a little bit earlier that the industry leader, Juul, says it is fighting underage vaping, but it's been on its own terms. Are you seeing that is effective, what they're doing so far?
I don't know how effective it is, but they pointed me back, and I'll share this with you. They said in the fall they chose to stop selling their flavored products in retail stores, and they moved all of that product online. So if you want to buy that stuff, you have to get it online. And they say that's an a better way because you have to go through this third-party age verification process. And then they again emphasize that they're focused on adult smokers. So they've been taking out full-page ads in the Sacramento Bee and prominent ads in Political's California newsletter, which go to a lot of Sacramento insiders because they say they want to educate the influencers on the fact that their product is really about adult smokers. And then the last thing they point to is being mixed up with smaller companies that make candy-flavored pods, like the flavors you talked about. And they say they only make four flavors. They make mint, mango, cream, and fruit. And then they make tobacco flavors as well.
But you can put those other flavors in their, their accessories. All right. That's Elizabeth Aguilera. She covers healthcare for Cal Matters. Thank you so much for joining us in the studio.
Thank you.
Coming up on Take Two, we have all the latest housing news for you. You might remember hearing about SB 50. It was a bill to encourage denser housing to help solve our huge housing crisis. But after all the fanfare, it was pretty much unceremoniously shelved. We find out what happened exactly, so stay with us. Back now with Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Josie Huang, filling in for A. Martinez. After lots of hope and lots of fanfare, SB 50, a state housing bill, died in Appropriations Committee earlier this week. The goal of the bill was to encourage denser multifamily housing near transit centers by waiving local zoning rules. It was seen as a radical solution by those who opposed it, and now only modest solutions remain. For more on what happened and where we go from here, we have Marisa Lagos. She's KQED's political correspondent. Welcome back to Take Two.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Well, I'd love for you to walk us through this journey that SB 50 had. Quite a journey, right? From inception to when it got shelved. What the heck happened?
Yeah, I mean, I guess to go back to the very beginning, we'd have to go back to last year, which is when Scott Wiener first introduced a bill. It had a different number then. And at the time, he kind of angered everyone. Folks who are on the affordable housing side and want to protect renters were very worried about displacement and the potential for gentrification. If you're building, you know, high rises around transit, maybe in neighborhoods that have already seen a lot of turnover. And then on the other side, you had cities and counties who are basically balking at the state telling them that they need to do anything around housing that they haven't already sort of decided to do at the local level. So I think there's a sort of long history in California of a lot of deference when it comes to local control. And so you saw that rear its head. It died last year. Wiener came back. I think he worked a lot harder to get folks on the side of renters and people worried about displacement. So he added in some language around, you know, having a limit in terms of like you can't just evict a whole building to build a bigger building, things like that. But you still had that very harsh opposition from folks in a lot of suburban areas, quite frankly. I think the big urban, you know, city mayors were behind this. But if you went out into the suburbs of the Bay Area or Los Angeles, there was not a lot of buy-in. And so essentially, this died the way a lot of bills died, which is in the Appropriations Committee with the chair just deciding not to let it go forward. It didn't even get a vote. They held it there. And what that means is that it can come back next January, but it's got a pretty short window if it does.
Yeah. And now how the bill died this year was because the chair of the Appropriations Committee, Senator Anthony Portantino, who represents La Cañada Flint Ridge, made the decision not to let it go forward. And sounds like you're not surprised that it is a senator from a wealthy suburb who decided to kill this bill.
I'm not. I mean, you know, folks like him, to be fair to Senator Portantino, this probably could have been a number of senators from around the state who would have had this opposition. But, you know, again, I think it really does speak of the sort of divide we're seeing here, which is that someone like Scott Wiener, who is representing a city like San Francisco, where people are commuting, just like in L.A., hours and hours to get to lower wage jobs or even middle income jobs, think that this is a real, you know, this is a moment that we need to seize. And people like Senator Portantino are saying, hang on, this is, you know, the character of our neighborhood. This is an issue of, you know, sort of dating back to how we've always treated cities and counties and given them this latitude. And why should the state come in and sort of upend that? And I think that, you know, within that, there's a lot of on the side of Wiener and people who support this bill, they see a lot of coded language there, that this NIMBYism isn't just about density. It's about the type of people that might live in those buildings, whether that's socioeconomic differences, whether that's racial differences. campuses. And so there's a lot of emotions on both sides.
Mm-hmm. Now that this bill has failed, there's been a target on Governor Newsom's back. He's come under criticism for its SB 50 not moving forward. The criticism is that he didn't really have much of a hands-on approach to steering this bill through Sacramento as much as he could have. Do you agree with that kind of criticism of him?
You know, I think it's a fair question. I think that any governor comes in and has to sort of walk a fine line between pushing the legislature in a direction they want to see them go and also understanding that this is a separate branch of government, an equal branch of government, and that if you kind of push too hard, you could risk a backlash. But given the housing crisis in California, given the affordability crisis, and given how much Newsom has pledged to work on that, promising on the campaign trail to build 3.5 million homes, which I think with current zoning you couldn't even do right now, I think there's questions about whether his office, if not him directly, should have been a little more involved in terms of maybe finding a compromise ahead of this appropriations deadline that could have been something that everyone could live with. I think there's also really valid questions for the Senate pro tem, President pro tem Toni Atkins of San Diego, who also has said in her whole career, mostly acted like she has a lot of investment in affordable housing and wanting to see more housing built. You know, she let Portantino kill this bill, and she's offered some reasons for why. But I think on both sides, you know, there's an open question as to whether if they had exercised a little more leadership, if the negotiations and compromise they say could happen could have happened sooner.
All right. Well, let's, you know, Newsom addressed this whole issue of leadership at a press conference following the shelving of the bill. Let's take a listen.
I'm meeting with the leadership and respect and their process, the respect of the pro tem and her comments. We're looking at options. And look, I'm not wedded to prescriptions of particular bills. I'm looking for all options to expand production in the state of California. My budget, as you know, includes $1.75 billion to jumpstart housing in the state of California.
So Newsom is there saying he plans to meet with leadership about SB 50. What could be the outcome of this kind of meeting at this point?
I think that's a good question. I mean, and again, I think it gets back to what we were just talking about, which is how much urgency do the pro tem and the governor and his staff see? Is this an issue that they think really does need to be tackled this year? I don't think so far that they've indicated that. But, you know, they do have this sort of legislative ability to revive a bill later in the session. All the rules, all the deadlines that we've been talking about are really of their own making. So if the governor and the pro tem and folks who have been opposed to this bill really came to the table and came up with a workable compromise, it could happen this year. It doesn't seem like they feel that urgency. And I think that that is raising, again, a lot of questions because this is such a huge issue in California. And because, as we all know, even if you change this law and it went into effect in January, it's not like you start building things overnight. So
right.
I think that, you know, it remains to be seen. There's still time in the session for something to happen, but it would require a lot of buy-in from Newsom and political capital.
Marisa Lagos is political correspondent at KQED. Thanks so much for taking the time with us.
My pleasure, Josie. Thanks for having me.
There's a growing number of empty homes in Southern California. Why? Construction has picked up so much that builders now have the biggest stock of unsold properties in 7 years. That may be bad news for developers, but it could be good for the region's housing crisis. For some Economics 101, we have Stuart Gabriel, professor of finance at UCLA and director of the UCLA Ziman Center for Real Estate. Welcome.
Hello, Josie.
So, Stuart, how many properties have been built recently, and how are builders able to build so much and so fast?
Well, builders are sometimes engaged in what we call speculative construction. Not all builders. Certain builders wait for new orders before they build, but others are seeking to address the ongoing shortage of housing in the state and are engaged in speculative construction.
But now they have on their hands a glut of homes, which I believe in the law of supply and demand means that there's a lot of supply, but that also means there should be less demand and competition for the homes that are out there. When will we see that have an effect on home prices, or has that already started to happen?
Excess supply in one place does not imply that we have improved affordability conditions in another. We're not sure there's much of a connection between the two, or at least not an immediate connection, in the sense that in our high-cost coastal economies running up and down the state, We have just absolutely an egregious shortage of affordable housing supply. And that's not getting fixed by this new construction, and it's not getting fixed anytime soon.
And what I hear you describing here is a very segmented housing market by geography. And why is it so challenging to make a dent in the housing crisis, as you mentioned, along the coastal part of California? Is there just so much demand to live in that area that there is not enough supply?
Well, that's basically it, Josie. It's complex because to create new supply, we need affordable land. And affordable land doesn't exist in these coastal communities.
Looking into the future, though, let's be optimistic here. And I'm curious what kind of things or what kind of data points you will be watching to tell you whether there will be any positive direction that housing availability and affordability, whether things will improve.
One of those will be pressures will come off some of these very hot, high-performing, expensive markets because of internal migration. And that will be helpful to affordability ultimately over the long run. The other thing is that there are tremendous profit incentives to figure out a way for the private sector to provide affordable units. And there are just a myriad of new laws that are seeking to pass through the state legislature that are seeking to damp the power of local government and to incent local government with carrots or sticks or whatever to engage in zoning of more affordable supply.
Several state lawmakers have tried to address the housing crisis through zoning. There was this failed effort to pass SB 50, which in a nutshell would have allowed more dense developments close to transit lines and job centers. Could any positive headway in tackling the housing crunch be for naught if these kind of proposed solutions keep facing hurdles?
Well, you know, the progress is incremental. That's not the only bill going through the legislature, and there are thematics that are coming into place. Now, maybe SB 50 is not going to pass on this round. Maybe they'll pass on a different round. But the point is, there are pieces of that legislation that are already coming into practice. And it's undeniably the case that we are densifying housing development along major transit lines. We're trying to create more compact cities, lower commute burdens, more efficient use of rapid transit. And those are big long-term, what we call secular trends. And those trends are going to continue with or without SB 50.
So it sounds like these kind of failed efforts to pass bills like SB 50 are in some ways incremental progress in that it's helping to turn public will or change public will over time?
No question about that. You know, there it's a bit of trial and error. Senator Weiner, the individual who authored SB 50, has been working on this for a while. Incrementally, this must be the direction we're going in. Because if we don't go in this direction, L.A. and San Francisco and San Diego and coastal western United States and eastern seaboard and the like will simply put themselves out of business because of this egregious lack of housing affordability.
All right. We've been talking to Stuart Gabriel. He's a professor of finance at UCLA and director of the UCLA Ziman Center for Real Estate. Stuart, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And now to a special birthday. The University of California, Los Angeles, better known as UCLA, turns 100 today. So we thought now might be a good time for a brief history lesson, starting with this tidbit. It wasn't always in Westwood. The campus actually started on Vermont Avenue just after World War I. In part because the original University of California in Berkeley had been receiving more students from Los Angeles than any other city. It was clear that LA, which already had more residents than San Francisco, needed its own campus. And so it began. In the years since, UCLA has yielded 24 Nobel laureates, and it now has 31,000 undergrad students with another 13,000 studying for advanced degrees. So, cheers to you, UCLA. Happy birthday. Here's to another 100 years of blue and gold. And coming up, have you been to Atwater Village recently for the restaurants, the yummy pastries they have there, that cool-looking sew shop I've always been meaning to go into? Well, imagine the neighborhood underwater. It's at risk of enduring a catastrophic flood. Find out how. Stick around on Take Two.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a doctorate of education in organizational leadership, developing graduates with the knowledge and ability to transform organizations for optimal success and growth. An online hybrid tailored for working professionals with attendance only twice per term in West LA. Attend an information session to learn more. Classes start in September. Apply by May 28th for a $1,500 scholarship opportunity at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Back with more Take Two. I'm Josie Huang in for A. Martinez. Yesterday on the show, we brought you the story of Project Portal. That's the effort to clean up the Port of Los Angeles with zero-emissions hydrogen-powered trucks. Today, we turn our attention to the push for more heavy-duty trucks that run on batteries. Here's Take Two's Sue Carpenter.
Giordano Sordoni grew up in Van Nuys in the 1990s.
I can still remember times that we would have recess canceled or even school canceled in some cases because the air quality was so bad.
As someone who suffered from asthma, he frequently ended up in the hospital as a result. So,
solving this problem is actually somewhat of a personal gripe for me.
Now Sordoni is doing something about it. Together with fellow 20-something Dakota Semler, he founded an electric truck company in North Hollywood. Formerly known as Thor Trucks, it's now called Exos. The company is currently working on a battery electric semi called the ET1, as well as smaller box trucks. And next month, one of the company's first trucks will go into service in Los Angeles in partnership with UPS.
All right, buckle up.
The rise of e-commerce is definitely having an effect on our decision for electrification because it's driving a lot of business.
Scott Philippi is Senior Director of Maintenance and Engineering for UPS. Already, the company operates more than 100,000 delivery vehicles globally and ships 6% of the entire world's gross domestic product. And that GDP is only expected to grow with on-demand deliveries. E-commerce is expected to double over the next 5 years in the U.S., and all those goods need to get where they're going.
There's a lot of people that talk about what's out there and what the future looks like, but you know, at the end of it all, UPS is where the rubber meets the road.
Scott Philippi.
We have a large responsibility to make a difference. And, you know, we have the scale that we can make change happen.
That change is just beginning. And a lot of it is happening right here in Los Angeles. The all-electric box truck UPS will put into service next month will be delivering packages in downtown L.A., where the truck is expected to make about 250 stops and travel about 100 miles each day. All those stops actually extend an electric truck's range, using something called regenerative braking that helps recharge the battery. The benefits to electric delivery trucks in an urban environment? Not only are they emissions-free, they have fewer moving parts than one that runs on diesel. And they're also quiet. But it's a chicken-and-egg situation. For all their benefits, electric trucks' ability to refuel with enough strategically located chargers will be critical for their success. Penske Truck Leasing is one company working on that, says spokesman Drew Cullen.
We just recently opened up four of what we believe to be the very first commercial heavy-duty electric truck DC fast charging stations in the country.
All are located in Southern California so far, including the Penske Service Center in La Mirada. Last year, Penske partnered with the country's largest truck maker, Daimler, to test 20 medium and heavy-duty battery electric trucks, which are just beginning to be used for real deliveries in the real world. Considering there are 3.5 million diesel trucks that currently operate in the U.S., it's a small step.
For the next 5 years, we don't think it's going to be anything earth-shattering.
Matt Trentacosta is an analyst with IHS Market.
We forecast that sales for electric, medium, and heavy-duty trucks in the U.S. will remain at less than 4% until 2025.
Southern California Edison has a part to play in making electric trucks a reality. Here's Director of E-Mobility, Katie Sloan.
The most cost-effective way to meet the state's goals is to clean the electric grid, which we are working towards, and to use that clean electricity to power transportation.
This week, the utility launched a $356 million program to fund the infrastructure necessary to recharge heavy-duty battery electric trucks. Charge Ready Transport aims to get about 870 charging sites up and running over the next 5 years, enough to let 8,500 battery electrics keep on trucking. From the infrastructure to the actual vehicles themselves, several companies are working on battery electric trucks, including Tesla, and much of that effort is happening here.
As a result of hundreds of millions of dollars flowing in to support incentive programs to get us out of dirty vehicles, we're seeing a number of manufacturers coming to California.
Richard Corey is executive director of the Air Resources Board. The agency is slated to receive $182 million from the state to incentivize zero-emissions heavy-duty vehicles in the coming fiscal year, under Governor Gavin Newsom's proposed budget, helping to make more expensive electric trucks cost-competitive with diesel.
There's 9 companies in California manufacturing these technologies, and I would take the position that it's the policies that we have that are sending a clear signal to bring your clean technologies to California. There's an opportunity here. Opportunity for manufacturing, opportunity to reduce emissions.
Opportunities that are now coming to fruition throughout the state, especially here in LA. For Take Two, I'm Sue Carpenter.
From the roads to our waterways now. Picture this. Catastrophic flooding along a 13-mile stretch of the LA River, reaching depths of up to 18 feet, covering 1,000 acres and affecting more than 2,000 properties. It's hard to imagine, I know, but that's a risk outlined by a U.S. Army Corps of Engineers study. While the chance of that happening is only 1% each year, the Atwater Village Neighborhood Council is sounding the alarm for residents. Karen Barnett chairs the council's River Committee and joins me now to talk about these efforts. Welcome to Take Two.
Thank you.
So please give us a brief overview of this Army Corps of Engineers study, which I'm sure you reviewed many times over, and what it found that relates to Atwater Village.
Atwater Village is 4 miles of this approximately 11 to 13 mile study. And what it found is that the river has lost volume capacity up to about 50%. Therefore, there is a greater risk of flooding, and we don't meet that 100-year FEMA standard, if you will.
And I'm going to stop you there and ask you to explain the 100-year flood standard.
And that means there's 1% chance of flood in any given year. So out of all the storms you may have in a year, one of them could be that 100-year. But the likelihood of that happening is over 100 years. But now with climate change and other factors, we've seen back-to-back 100-year storms in certain areas.
And geographically, what makes this flood-prone and what makes it tricky to protect?
There's several factors. One, the channel itself has a built-as rating of 50 to 100-year protection.
What kind of rating is that?
It's built as.
Built as, okay.
Yeah, so it was never built to hold a 100-year flood
I see.
Event. So with that not being to the 100-year standard, then you add in the sediment buildup, the vegetation buildup, and then we've been building a lot since 1930s when it was initially constructed. I believe our section was finished in the 60s or the late 50s.
And in the event of a flood, what is the situation around exit routes? Would it be easy to get in and out?
In Atwater Village, I'd have to say not really, because we only have 3 main streets to enter and exit, and that would be Fletcher Drive, Glendale Boulevard, and Los Feliz Boulevard. And North Atwater has an additional 2. We're kind of locked in on our borders by the river itself, which has bridges, and then the rail, which has over and underpasses are currently some at grade crossings.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's troublesome. Well, because of this study that the Army Corps did, it's now recommending FEMA flood insurance remapping along the LA River we've been talking about.
Mm-hmm.
What does this mean for the residents who live in this area?
That kind of remains to be determined, because the city kicked off the remapping process in April of 2017, and it's still in progress. So we don't actually know what the results are going to be to potentially 2, 3, 5, or 10 years. But what we do know is that whoever is in that designated area, if they have a federally backed mortgage, they will have to purchase flood insurance. Now, it doesn't have to be from FEMA, but that generally is the best pricing. But who knows when and what will happen and how that might even change. You can still buy private insurance and whatnot, but it is federal law that federally backed mortgages, which is most, are mandated to have high-risk flood insurance.
So whether you go with public insurance, the federal insurance, or private insurance, how much is that going to set residents back if you were to ballpark it?
It can be anywhere from $1,700 to, let's say, $7,000.
You mentioned a little bit earlier that this study came out in 2016, so it's been 3 years. Why are you and the rest of the neighborhood council sounding the alarm now?
There hasn't been any outreach to our community and, to my knowledge, others about the potential special flood hazard area. And it has a great impact on our physical and financial safety. So we felt it was time to let the residents know where everything is at, which, you know, we don't know where it's going to go, but at least we want to inform people of the current situation, what the potential outcomes may be, the effects, and then what we could do to mitigate some of these things. And we as a community can take action to potentially lessen the special flood hazard area designation, maybe make it smaller so less parcels are affected by that mandated requirement of high-risk flood insurance. And that can happen with the Army Corps studying flood mitigation, maybe flood walls or other design features. The city increasing its community response rate, which would require more flood outreach and evacuation plans and whatnot. And then also that rating increases our discount for flood insurance.
Karen Barnett chairs the Atwater Village Neighborhood Council's River Committee. Karen, thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you.
We have more Take Two for you this hour. We're headed to the beach next, Cardiff State Beach to be exact, not for sunning or swimming, but to talk about climate change and how we can protect beaches from the elements. Stay with us to find out how exactly to do that. Back with Take Two, I'm Josie Huang, filling in for A. Martinez today. Encinitas city officials held a ribbon-cutting ceremony yesterday, not for a new building or a new park, but for sand dunes at Cardiff State Beach. That's because engineered dunes might be one of our best shots at protecting some beaches from the ravages of climate change. KPCC's science reporter Jacob Margolis has the story.
Sometimes a pile of sand is just a pile of sand, but sometimes a pile of sand is really exciting.
What is the scene in front of us that I'm looking like?
So these are sand dunes.
Special sand dunes that could help save our beaches. I'll tell you about them in a minute. Construction crews are just putting their finishing touches on them. They rise about 3 feet above the highway, run along Cardiff Beach, and stand like a bouncer, protecting you from the Pacific Ocean that's about, you know, 200 yards away. For the past 5 years, Brian Leslie, a coastal scientist with the firm GHD, has helped design and build these dunes. And that was needed, because the beach was disappearing.
In the past, what this has looked like is no beach at all, really. And sometimes you had waves going over the highway. You had these cobbles, small rocks, being thrown onto the highway. And just kind of a cleanup issue and also a road closure issue.
Coastal cities are always battling erosion. It's normal. In response, many just nourish their beaches. That means they dump a bunch of sand to build them up during winter. Sometimes they line a road with rocks to save infrastructure, like homes and sewage systems. But now, cities are having to rethink how they protect their beaches, because rising sea levels, caused by climate change, are becoming an even greater threat. Which brings us back to disappearing Cardiff Beach.
It needed the city to immediately react. It was already experiencing flooding, and it was already experiencing storm surge.
Jamie Timberlake is tackling sea level rise for Encinitas. The city wanted a long-term solution that would look better and last longer than dumping a bunch of sand. Hence, what they call living dunes. They're normal piles of sand, but more engineered. Beneath the top layer of sand are carefully stacked rocks of different sizes that go down about 10 feet deep. When the ocean hits the dunes, the rocks will shift around like marbles to absorb that energy, hopefully saving the road. On top of the dunes, there's vegetation and fencing that's supposed to stop the sand from blowing away.
The Cardiff Project is very unique. Like, nobody's really tried that before in California.
Nick Sajapour is a science research and policy specialist at USC's Sea Grant program.
And I think it's a better solution than what we've used before, because you just nourish a beach. If you get a storm in a month on a high tide, all that sand that you spent, you know, hundreds of thousands or $1 million on is going to be gone.
The living dunes are one big experiment that'll be monitored by researchers from Scripps and UCLA, as well as by the city of Encinitas. They'll watch to see how they erode, how often they need to be topped off, and the kind of habitat they provide for native species. And if they're effective, we could see similar projects pop up and down California's coast, as cities try to save their beaches from climate change. The thing is, they weren't cheap, costing roughly $3 million. And even if they are successful, they may only work for another 20 or 30 years.
Yeah, the dunes are likely not a forever solution here.
That's Brian, the guy who helped build them.
But eventually, it's going to be tough to keep up with sea level rise. Once we get into like the 3 feet and over, it's going to be really difficult to keep a dune system here.
That's something Encinitas is starting to consider. What new techniques they might be able to use to save their beloved beaches, or if they'll even be able to 30 years from now. Covering science, I'm Jacob Margolis.
And finally, some promising news for the new moms out there. State senators passed a bill Tuesday that would require employers to provide private rooms for moms to nurse or to pump breast milk. I'm not talking about closets. No more closets. No more bathroom stalls. Actual rooms. Those spaces would also need access to running water and a place to keep things cool, like a fridge or a space for a cooler. The bill supporters say offering these accommodations will increase worker retention, but opponents like the California Chamber of Commerce say this is too burdensome for employers. Well, as someone with a nine-month-old, I find this bill quite intriguing. KPCC does give me and the other moms here a space to pump, but I've been out on assignment before where I've had a pump in my car or a closet, and I can tell you it is grim. But I wonder what your thoughts are about this bill. Did your workplace have a lactation room, or are you pumping in some weird, dark, cramped space? Tweet at us at Take Two. And by the way, new moms, we see you and you are doing awesome. All right. Thanks so much for listening to Take Two today. Come back tomorrow. The water's really nice here. We'll talk to you then.